Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Navigating the ins and outs of financial services in Canada is hard enough, but imagine if you're new to the country. The challenges facing new immigrants are enormous. We're going to look at some of the challenges and some of the solutions with Ivy Chu. She focuses on new immigrants at RBC. And finding a great real estate agent is really, really important, but not really, really easy. There's a new online tool that might be able to help. Whether you're buying or selling a home, FeeDuck connects you with a real estate agent through an auction process. Its co-founder will be here. Then, passive investing has been a thing for years, but it can be a tough bandwagon to jump on. There's a new web-based software program out there called Passive. That's P-A-S-S-I-V. We'll talk to its co-founder, Brendan Lee Young. Plus the gender gap in personal finance, insight on new research from CPA Robin Topp. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Whether you're in the process of moving to Canada, you just arrived, or are still settling in, navigating the world of finance can come with its challenges, that's for sure. RBC has been focused on this particular demographic for a fairly long time. They've got a number of initiatives to help newcomers manage those very specific challenges. Ivy Chu is the Senior Director of RBC's Newcomer Segment. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
I want to talk about the different types of newcomers, because I'm sure that the circumstances are very different depending on how they arrived here and what life is like now that you're here. How would you sort of articulate some of the scenarios in which Canadians, new Canadians, find themselves here?
Yeah, and first of all, thank you so much for having me today. And we see newcomers ranging from permanent residents coming as a family to solo international students studying and living abroad for the first time, or a temporary foreign worker sponsored by their companies abroad. So some might just want to open a bank account upon arrival, and some might be looking for a credit card, and others might be wishing to buy a home.
What about those for whom the circumstances are much more troubling? They're fleeing war-torn countries, they're here as refugees, those kinds of folks.
Yeah, we see refugees as well, and we do have products that are specifically designed for refugees to address their challenges.
As a Canadian who was born here, who spent my life here, and who had a dad who spent lots of time talking about money, I had many advantages that new Canadians wouldn't necessarily have. Give us a sense of some of the financial challenges or barriers that they often face.
Yeah, so one common challenge is the fact that they don't have a credit history in Canada. And as you know, so many things that we do in our day-to-day life relies on the fact that you have a credit history here. So we try to help newcomers address this challenge by providing them with a credit card that doesn't require you to have credit history, and we help them establish this credit history in Canada.
How do they deal with the fact that our system, I guess like any system, has an enormous amount of acronyms and tax laws and just 12,000 things for them to learn? Is that overwhelming for new Canadians, do you think?
Absolutely. That's actually one of the most common questions that we see. People ask us things like, what's the difference between an RSP and a TFSA? Because that's not something that is available in their home country necessarily. Or even whether they should set up an RESP for their children and what are the implications of that. So first of all, we are happy to provide the financial literacy to anyone who comes through our door in terms of just explaining what are the differences and what are the implications. And then secondly, we would try to help them decide whether this particular RSP or RSP or whatever product they're looking into would be suitable for their circumstances.
There's the knowledge piece, so you educate them on you know, what an RSP is and all that stuff. But I can imagine there's also a pretty significant cultural piece in that. In some cultures, banks aren't to be trusted. Real estate's the only thing that matters. You always do things in cash. You know, there's a bias against taking credit, those kinds of things. What are some of the cultural issues that your group at the bank needs to be sensitive to?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there are certain countries where credit card is not common. In fact, phone banking might be more common. And there might be other cultures where they don't necessarily trust big banks. And that's something that is quite different in Canada. We have such a well-regulated industry. So, and I think us as Canadians, we probably benefit from that. So much of the time, we are sharing our knowledge with them and educating them on why it's different and how our laws are different from other countries, from where they come from necessarily. And one of the most pronounced differences actually we see in terms of cultural is the job search process. So not necessarily pertaining to banking, but it's something that newcomers face all the time. One of the top issues that they face when they come here is whether they can find a job and how to find a job. And you can imagine finding a job in Canada is very different from finding a job in other places of the world. So that's something that we help them with.
What would be an example? I think I'm so ingrained in how it works here that I don't know that I would know that it's that different in other places.
Yeah. So, for example, in other parts of the world, it's quite common to have a photograph with your resume. And that's something that that obviously we don't do in Canada. And so when they come through our doors and ask us for advice on things like that, this is something that we would help them with. There are branches that we have that are dedicated to servicing newcomers, and we actually help them with resume writing and job search preparation. And we do this in conjunction with Access Employment, which is a very well-known nonprofit organization that is dedicated to servicing newcomers. Mm.
You provide service in something like 200 languages, is that correct?
Yes.
How does that even work?
Yeah, so we use something called a language line, which is a simultaneous translation service. So basically, we can provide a service through the phone or through a video. And the client comes through our branch, and our advisors basically use this technology to provide simultaneous translation. So we do it over the phone. We have over 200 languages that are represented. And if we do it by video, we have over 30 languages that are represented.
Wow, it's like being at the United Nations or something.
Exactly.
Now, some people who arrive in Canada do not have records from their former country, especially those who are fleeing strife back home. How do you work around that on the credit front?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the key challenges that newcomers face is the fact that they don't have a local credit score. So we help them establish a Canadian credit history by giving them a credit card that doesn't require history. And then we provide them with advice and education to build up that history through credit card usage and what that means and how to avoid fees and interest rates. So I'll give you an example. One of the recent examples that I've seen was visiting one of our branches on campus, and there was a student coming in just asking for a credit card, and our banking advisor actually asked more questions to see, well, what exactly does this student need? Why does he need a credit card? And we found out that this is going to be his fourth credit card, and he was planning to put his tuition on the credit card. So we ended up not giving him a credit card, so we didn't actually sell him the product. Mm. We actually advised that, you know, you should not be putting your tuition on the credit card, and because of these reasons, these are the implications, these are the interest rates, and we actually discourage him from getting additional credit cards and actually just use one rather than having three or four.
Now, some people come from, you know, Western countries, maybe the UK or Australia, where they already have an established credit history. How does that port over to Canada? Does it port over to Canada?
It doesn't. I believe if you are from the U.S., then we do have a way of checking your credit history. But for most newcomers coming from other countries, we do not use the credit history that is not based in Canada.
You have something called the Meeting Place. What is that and how does it work?
Yeah, we are very excited about Meeting Place because it's a brand new branch format that we launched recently. And for us, Meeting Place is dedicated to a particular type of client, such as newcomers or youth and students. So I'll use newcomer as an example. So we have a Meeting Place in Brampton, and that is dedicated to surfacing newcomers, answering any questions a newcomer might have, from where to catch a bus and how to find a job and how to find a home. And most of the employees at that location were former newcomers themselves. Hmm. So they are very knowledgeable and passionate about helping our clients who are newcomers. And a brand new Meeting Place that we just launched is one that we are co-located with Access Employment. And because Access is very good at servicing newcomers, so we thought this is a perfect synergistic way for us to service these clients together.
RBC's partnered with the Toronto Regional Immigrant Employment Council. What does that partnership look like to new Canadians?
Yeah, so we are very excited about our brand new national mentoring program with TRIAC. We've actually been working with TRIAC for a number of years, and we are very good partners with them, and we realize that part of our mission and part of our corporate values is servicing our communities and helping our clients thrive. And Triac has the same mission in terms of helping newcomers thrive. So we got together and decided that it would be very beneficial for newcomers if we were to launch a mentor match program together. What that means is we and other organizations provide mentors. Many of them were former newcomers, and Triac would help us match mentees to mentors, and basically having experienced former newcomers helping new newcomers to the country.
Mm. Now, I am interested in the whole new immigrant story as it relates to personal finance, but obviously RBC is talking about all sorts of initiatives that will serve you as a for-profit publicly traded company. So I want to ask you, how big of a market is this? You wouldn't be focused on it if it was only to do good in the world. There must be profit for you down the road. How big a segment is this?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Newcomers are very important for RBC, but we also think it's important to Canada. So as you know, looking at Canada, newcomers is really one of the key ways for the country to grow and also for RBC to grow. And so we are very focused on it, partly because of the business imperative we have, and also because it's aligned to our values of helping our communities. So in terms of the opportunity, we do see an increase of immigrants coming into Canada. And I believe the numbers are something like around 300,000 plus permanent residents coming in each year. And that's not including international students and temporary foreign workers.
Interesting. It's a big opportunity. Ivy, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ivy Chu, Senior Director of RBC's Newcomer segment, talking about some of the challenges that new Canadians face when they arrive in our country and some of the solutions out there, both in the for-profit and not-for-profit world. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, FeeDuck. I know. What's that? It's an online tool that connects you with the perfect real estate agent. At least they think it'll be a perfect match. Who knows? And later, Brendan Lee Young's here to talk about Passive, a web-based software program that uses a passive investing strategy to help you manage your portfolio. If this isn't enough moolala for you, and who's kidding? It's not enough. We've got a massive archive of former or prior segments. Go to moolala.ca, click Buy Media on the top right page and look for podcasts. All of our episodes and segments are online on the site and on your podcast provider. Stay with us. There's more moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Have you ever created a dating profile? Thankfully, I have been married so long, I missed that particular technological advance. But I hear that you have to, you know, plug in your interests and what you're looking for, all in the hopes that you're going to find the perfect match. FeeDuck is kind of like that, but for real estate agents. If you're looking to buy a home, finding the best agent for you, someone who's going to meet your needs, can be kind of difficult, especially if you don't have a strong referral. FeeDuck is an online tool that is trying to make it simple. You plug in some basic information about the kind of home you're selling, and FeeDuck takes it from there. Its co-founder is Warren Mascarenhas. He is here to tell us more. Hello there.
Hi, how are you doing?
FeeDuck, what does that even mean, FeeDuck?
It's ducking fees.
Ducking fees.
Yes.
Okay, because I'm just picturing the actual duck swimming in the water. Ducking fees. I got it. Okay, so how does it work?
So what it is, it's home sellers and buyers leverage the demand for their business by having real estate agents compete for it. So on the seller side, a real estate agent would bid down a commission rate. And on the buyer side, a real estate agent would bid up a rebate. So at the end of the auction, they would get cash back in their pocket in both ways.
So I'm a consumer. I'm looking to sell my house, for example. I go on FeeDuck, and what happens from there?
So you'd enter in some information about your house, right? Your street, your size of house, what you're looking for a real estate agent to provide services, whether it be comprehensive marketing package, virtual tours. You then enter into an auction in which agents that service your particular area would be notified. They would log on. They would bid down their commission rate based on the variables that you've put in. So, you know, services that you want provided based on property details. At the end of the auction, you get an introduction to an agent. who's willing to sell your house for a lower commission rate.
Now, we're a national show. Commissions can vary regionally.
Yeah.
Give us an example of what a current commission is and how the auction process might bring that commission down.
Absolutely. So in Ontario, it's usually 2.5% for the seller and 2.5% for the buying agent, so a combined 5%.
Okay.
So an average in the GTA, with FIDUC, you're probably looking around 3%, right? So you're saving about 2% on commission fees. Out west, they have a system where the first 100,000 is either 6% or 7%, and then the remaining is 3%. And we would bid down the remaining portion because you get the most value of that.
Why would an agent be willing to leave so much of their commission, or not leave it on the table, but give it back to the seller in this case?
That's a great question. So what we do is we've tried to go out and talk to our agents, especially the more successful ones on our platform, the more successful agents just in general. And the two points that we tend to hear most often is, one, you're getting direct access to a qualified, very verified lead. So you're not spending thousands of dollars on billboard ads or on bus stops. This is, you're paying for the lead that you get. And the second one, which tends to be the bigger one, is you're getting more for sale signs on lawns. And when it comes to real estate agents, the best marketing that you could have is for sale and sold signs. That's how you're going to grow your brand. That's how you're going to maintain your brand.
How does FIDUC make money?
So we get paid from the winning agent. So he pays us for that lead, for administrating the auction, for the right to an introduction to the home seller or buyer.
How much?
170 plus taxes.
170 bucks. Yeah. So if you're an agent, you're thinking, okay, I can spend 170 bucks in this way, or I can spend 170 bucks sponsoring the community fun fair, and that's popcorn, and what I put out some flyers, and maybe I'll get a client, maybe I won't. You're saying, well, you're going to quite likely get a client because you won this auction. How many, what's the percentage of those who are matched on FIDUC that end up moving forward in a business relationship, and what percentage drops off?
So we have about a mid 70% connection rate. So what that means is the agent gets the introduction. They'll meet with the home seller or buyer. They'll present what their services are going to offer, and then they're going to move forward to the listing stage. So at that listing stage, we have about a 70 to 75% connection rate, depending on territory.
So 70% move to the listing stage, where we have a deal. We've got a signed piece of paper that says we're going to work together. I'm not going to work with 12 other agents. I'm going to work with you.
Yeah.
70% of the time.
Yeah.
How do you vet agents?
So
there's so many. How many agents are in Canada, by the way? I don't even know. Like tons.
Well, I can tell you around Toronto alone, it's over 50,000.
50.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there is definitely a lot. So
you vet 50,000 agents?
The agents that sign up on our platform.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So how do you vet the ones that sign up?
We do have about a 55% approval rate. So 45% of agents that sign up don't meet the qualifications.
How many?
The criteria. About 45% of the
do
agents.
Not.
Yeah. So what we look for is, A, you got to work for one of a full service brokerages, like your REMAXes, your Century 21s. Two is we're looking for someone with good, strong online marketing presence. If I'm on an online platform and I see an agent, the first thing I'm going to do is Google that person. So they have to have good online presence. And three is they got to have no knocks on them on the real
estate. Where do you get that? So you go to the real, you take the applicant and you match it with their real estate board profile.
Yeah.
What's your way to vet jerks? How do you vet the jerks? How do you get the jerks off the platform?
Real estate agents?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I say that not as a knock on real estate. It's just in every industry.
Absolutely.
There are people who are amazing and people who are jerks.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple ways. One is you can look at online reviews, which we do in our vetting process.
It's
right?
Laborious. How long do you take to vet a person? Like, does that a human thing, or do you have AI that can do this for you?
No, right now it's human, unfortunately. But hopefully we'll get to the stage where we can have some sort of artificial intelligence do that for us. The second part is they tend to vet themselves out. So, you know, we do listen to our sellers. We do listen to our buyers. We communicate with them when we verify our leads. So we do have a conversation with our buyers and sellers as well, and we'll follow up with them after. So if we start getting any negative feedback on an agent, the first thing we'll do is we'll provide them with another option, and we'll have a conversation with that agent, right? And if it's a reoccurring thing, that agent's going to be kicked off our platform.
How do you factor in the intangibles? So there are many things. Great that I got a cut, a discount on the commission, but do they get – if I'm a buyer, do they get my sense of style? Do they communicate in a way that I want to communicate? How do you factor those other things? Or is that after the auction was won, you meet them and you say, they just don't get me?
Yeah, exactly. So the seller and the buyer, they aren't committed – to the real estate agent that they get from FEDUC. They still have to go through the whole process of meeting with them and making sure that's a proper fit, right? So it's zero cost and zero risk for a seller or a buyer. The plus is you're getting either rebate or you're saving thousands in commissions. But if you meet with a real estate agent and it's not the fit, then we always ask our sellers and buyers to circle back, give us some feedback. And if we have a real estate agent in mind that matches what you're looking for, we'll make that introduction.
Do you think your service is going to increase fee competitiveness in the marketplace?
Among agents?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Because normally people just take the fee as the fee as the fee as the fee.
Exactly.
You don't think about dickering on it because it just is the fee. Now it introduces the prospect that we could actually negotiate our fees, whether we go through FEDUC in the auction process or we just, you know, call up a person whose sign we have seen and you say, listen, I think you can do better on the fee. Give me a better price.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think more and more people are getting comfortable with the fact that they can negotiate real estate fees. Not a lot of people knew that those fees that you can negotiate down. I think we're bringing more and more attention to it. And I think the easier it makes our sellers and buyers to get into houses, the better it is. That's kind of what we're going for.
Do you believe that the real estate market and the concerns about it now are better for your business or worse for your business? Like in the heyday 2 years ago, it's like anything sells. It's going for $1 billion more than it was last year.
Yeah.
Which is better, the euphoria and the speculative market or something that's more measured and more perhaps more competitive?
Well, more measured, more competitive means there's going to be more agents that are
just hungry.
Yeah, exactly, right? So both works. When the market's booming, you obviously have more volume out there, some more inventory. And when the inventory is down a little bit, you just have more demand for the actual lead. So both works for us. We've noticed that across Canada, there's times when BC is hot and Alberta might not be. And there's signs when Montreal is hot right now and Toronto is kind of taking a step back. So it kind of all balances itself out.
Would a top agent ever engage in an auction process?
Yes.
It would seem to me that they've got referrals. Why would they denigrate their profit margin?
So first of all, agents that are on our site are anonymous. So people don't go on. They can't see what agents are on there. So they're not really taking knock on their brand. But it goes back to the second point I mentioned prior, where you get more for sale and sold signs and you're maintaining that branding.
Interesting. Warren, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks, Bruce. Appreciate the time.
Warren Mascarenhas is with FEDUC, co-founder of FEDUC, a service that matches you as a consumer with a real estate agent at a better fee than they would have offered otherwise. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Brendan Lee Young, co-founder of Passive, on how his software can make passive investing simpler. And later, Robin Tobe is here with new research on the financial gender gap. Now, you can download full episodes of the podcast on any of the podcast platforms out there. While you're there, feel free to write us a review or even subscribe so the next episode will arrive right on your device. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Passive investing has been in the mainstream for the better part of a decade, but there are still a lot of people who believe in the strategy, jazzed about the strategy, want to try the strategy, but haven't actually adopted the strategy themselves. There is a new web-based software program called Passive that might help. Brennan Lee Young co-founded the company, and he is here now to talk about it. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. How's it going?
So how does this work?
It's really simple. You basically create an account with Passive, link your Questrade brokerage account to Passive, set a target allocation, and then set up recurring contributions, and we'll tell you what you need to buy and let you know when your cash hits your account to buy it.
Now, you actually need to push the button and transact.
Yes, you do.
That is the way it works. So that's one difference between Passive and a robo-advisor, which provides some asset allocation. Well, it doesn't provide asset allocation advice. It actually does it for you. Give us the full explanation of where Passive fits in the market. So there's robo-advisors that would do that. There's DIY, where you've got a spread, crummy little spreadsheet. And then there's you.
Right. So basically, our software is great for someone that has a crummy little spreadsheet and just does not want to do the manual data entry and then have to take those calculations and log into their brokerage account and buy trades. So Passive is almost like it's an app for someone that wants to be a passive investor but just does not want to pay a scaling fee to...
One of the things that makes it hard if you've got the crummy little spreadsheet is how expensive some of these shares are. That makes it hard to buy each month. So you want to buy shares of Apple or Google, you got to save up for a long period of time to do that. How does your software account for the fact that people aren't saving $10,000 a month? Maybe they're saving $500 a month.
Right. So what we do is first we help you find the underweight assets in your portfolio. So you sort of limit the amount of buys you make just by buying the underweight asset. And most of our users, they have and invest in low-cost ETFs. And so they are a lot cheaper than, let's say, an Apple share price, which I think is like $400
or
something. So basically, if you're following a passive investing strategy using low-cost diversified ETFs...
The dollar ring's not going to be $1,000,
exactly,
necessarily. Now, the cost, so there's a community cost and then an elite cost. Community's free, is that right?
That's
elite's
correct.
$5 a month. How on earth do you expect to make any money?
Well,
$5 a month is not a lot of money. That is a lot of users. Let's say that. So that's what? So that's $60 a year. It is a lot of users for you to make any money.
Yeah. So that
is this a philanthropic endeavor?
Well, part of it is where our team is do-it-yourself investors. And, you know, like we kind of believe that, you know, like you shouldn't have to pay a scaling fee to, let's say, a robo-advisor if you genuinely want to invest on your own. So we're like, well, let's build this thing, put it out there, see if folks like it. And if we make some money from it, great. If not, at least we're giving back to individuals.
Right.
And it's like a tool that you can use to manage your family's investments.
What additional features do elite users get?
So right now you get the ability to have Passive make those trades for you. You can exclude your one-off stock picks, like my business partner, he wanted to buy, let's say, the marijuana ETF.
Of course, I was going to guess.
I know, like everyone...
All the cool kids are buying the marijuana ETF.
Right, but you probably don't necessarily want to have that as part of your retirement portfolio. So you want to exclude that asset from your balance fund. So you get the ability to exclude stock picks from your target allocation. So it's just a nice way of separating your retirement savings from your play money within your account.
You're partnering with Questrade in Canada. Any other plans to partner with other brokerages, go outside of our borders? What's the future look like?
Yeah, so we're right now looking to partner with some brokerages in the U.S., and that'll help us with our small annual
fee. See, I'm concerned about you. I'm concerned about you making some money, so you better find a way to make some money.
Yeah, no, we're
so
looking
US,
at
US, but would you partner with more brokerages in Canada, or do they have an exclusive deal?
So right now we're exclusive to Questrade, and the plan is to just focus on going after the US.
Strategic question: Why not just be a service offered by an institution like Questrade? Why be a third party? Why establish this as a brand? I ask because it seems like it'd be a great add-on for Questrade to just have it and for everybody to have it. Any discount brokerage should have a white-labeled version of Passive because it's super easy. And why did you not go that route? Or did I just come up with $1 million answer and you're going to go back to your office and be like, Bruce is so smart?
Well, we're sort of like... trying to, we try to partner with them, but they seem to not be interested in partnering with us. Like, they're doing their own things. And like Questrade, they were the only platform we've supported. They saw the value in what we were doing, and they were like, this is great for our users, so let's roll with them.
Why did you decide not to offer a recommendation on asset allocation?
Because then you'd be given advice, and we want to be a software company and don't want to be in the business of giving advice to Canadians.
Now, I mean, the counterpoint to that is a blogger like Dan Bortolotti, who writes the Couch Potato blog, he has benchmarks. Rob Carrick has been. There's tons of people out there who provide benchmarks that aren't, air quotes, licensed in a traditional way. Even in my first book, I provide benchmarks like 10% of this, 10% of that. Wouldn't that be something that the market's looking for?
Yes, we actually have plans in version 2 of Passive. We're doing a major overhaul of our UX, but the plan is to include model portfolios in there that the user can select.
What was the light bulb for you on passive investing?
It was sort of like a come to Jesus moment when, you know, like you're trying to beat the market, but you read books and you realize you can't. I got into value investing very early, and I thought, well, geez, if I can find the best undervalued companies and buy them, then I'd be rich. Wrong.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way. And then even in finding these undervalued companies, it's like a day job. And when you look at those professionals out there whose job it is to beat the market, and 85% of them don't beat the market, I sort of resigned myself to just saying, I'll just buy the market. I'm happy with the market's returns. Maybe I'll have some fun money off into the sides and try to get, you know, above market returns. But for the most part, I'm trying to retire. So passive investing is the best way to go if you're trying to save for retirement.
How do you compete with the consumer experience that the robos offer? I remember it was probably like 2 years ago. I was having a battle with my bank over something. I needed to do something. I had to go into a branch and an hour and a half. I knew it was going to take forever, so I brought my lunch. Like, it was like, ugh. And then I came into to work, and this millennial had signed up for a robo-advisor in 5 minutes. She's like, oh, yeah, it's really easy, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
How do you compete with the level to which they have progressed on customer experience?
So what we're doing is we're partnering with Questrade, so they're going to help us find users. And basically, you gotta know a bit about your target allocation, what you invest in. So that's why we're not really trying to compete with robo-advisors. We're more trying to help the individuals that are already investing carry out their strategies without having to use Excel. Like, I think robo-advisors are great for folks who have no clue, no desire to manage their money. Our product is for folks that know what they want to invest in, but just don't want to have to use Excel to maintain that portfolio and keep it balanced. So,
to give us a sense for what else is in the future for the company, you talked a little bit about other things, 2.0. What about 3.0 and 4.0? Where is this going over the next 5 years?
Well, I'd like to see passive helping folks invest in a tax-efficient manner. So we've got a lot of users that have multiple investment accounts, and they want to treat all of those assets as one global portfolio. So in the next 2 months, we'll be releasing the ability to rebalance across multiple accounts and have that treated as one portfolio as well.
Interesting. Brendan, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much.
Brendan Lee Young co-founded a company called Passive, a web-based software program that helps you manage your investments following a passive strategy. Stay with us. Coming up next, are men, in fact, more financially literate than women? Robin Tobe has some new data on that question. And how I do it, we'll ask Ivy Chu about how she manages her money. If you want to keep up with me on social media, I am on Twitter at Bruce Celery, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. I hesitated there for a second because technically I'm on Instagram, but I am the worst on Instagram, the worst. So maybe I should get better at that. Stick around. We will be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Celery. on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A quick Google search on personal finance and gender yielded 170 million results. So much data, so many different opinions. Add this to the mix. A new study from CPA Canada provides some nuance on the discussion, weaves in some insight on personality traits. Robin Tobe is an accountant, author, financial expert, and she's here now to tell us more about a bunch of these factors and provide some new perspective on the financial gender gap. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
We could talk about this every day, all day, because it's fascinating to me, especially as a parent of a nine-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the CPA research. What are the most relevant findings for you here?
I think there's a perception that men are more financially literate than women. And what this study did was it dug deeper into this issue of gender. And what it came out with was that when you dig into it, there are other factors that have a very large influence on our attitudes towards money, our habits, and our knowledge. And those things are socioeconomic factors like age, income, and education. But more interestingly, personality. So your actual hardwired personality. And it kind of looked at different things like how good you are at making ends meet, how good you are at keeping track of money, planning ahead, things like that. And what it found was that for those three things, there was very little difference between men and women. But for things like choosing financial products, staying informed about finances, and actual financial knowledge, your personality had a lot more to do with it than your gender.
Now, both StatsCan and CPA have provided some data on financial literacy. It's always so disappointing because the scores are so low. But tell us more about the difference there that those studies found.
Yeah, so you're right. The scores are usually low in general, like, you know, C plus for men versus D minus for women when it comes to things like financial knowledge quiz, like answering some basic questions correctly. But what it found was that women aren't significantly different from men when it comes to making ends meet, keeping track, budgeting, planning, like some basic financial planning stuff.
Do you make the inference then that a female's concern about her ability in that area is societal?
Well, that's
the other. She thinks she's not as good?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is how confident do women versus men feel about money? Or when they're self-assessing how knowledgeable they are, usually women show that they feel like they're less knowledgeable. And I think, yeah, there were societal norms that made men in charge of that sphere. That they were kind of, you know, the breadwinners and they were in charge of the money and women were kind of told not to worry so much about that.
This personality traits thing is fascinating to me. There's an acronym that is OCEAN and it references five different traits, the first being openness to experience. Tell us a bit more about these traits and how they weave into the financial world.
Yeah, so these traits are well established in the psychiatry or psychology field. And so they're openness, conscientiousness, which is something you may have heard referred to as grit. That's kind of being talked about a lot. Extroversion, which is positive emotionality. Agreeableness. And then lastly, neuroticism, which kind of gets a bad
rap. First four are totally me. This is the fifth one. I don't even, never would that be used to describe me.
Negative emotionality. Never.
Like, never.
And of those five, some have nothing or really not gender correlated, but conscientiousness, agreeableness, and neuroticism, the research has shown that there's gender differences. And on average, and I'm not saying this is true for every man and everyone, but on average, women tend to be more conscientious, specifically when it comes to things like discipline. They tend to be more agreeable, which is sort of, you know, being pleasant, kind of being cooperative, going along, going with the flow, as opposed to questioning and skeptical. And they tend to be more neurotic, which means more displaying more negative emotions.
What is your personal take as a author, financial expert, seasoned businesswoman on this research?
To me, it resonated because I felt like, if you think about your own personality, and I think about myself, highly conscientious, quite agreeable, I don't think I'm crazy neurotic. That's my family.
Your family will tell you, maybe say something different.
But somewhat. Like, there is some reactivity. Yeah,
but you have a background in numbers. Like, do you have a confidence question about your ability to manage the
math?
Not
at all.
And you never did.
And I never did. And again, I think that's part of a kind of like a virtuous cycle, in that I was always kind of good with math, confident with math, and then it just became something that I sought out more because I enjoyed it. And, I did a BCom like you, Bruce, and then I became a CPA.
Yeah.
So I've always been very comfortable in that sphere. And, each experience I've had has led me to become even more confident, plus the training that I had, especially the training as an accountant. Like, it's very rigorous with numbers. So I've always felt comfortable in the financial world. And I also felt like I was playing to my strengths because I am really conscientious. So that makes you a good financial planner. It makes you a good investor. You're very disciplined. You're going to stick to your plan. And then if you know, the agreeableness can kind of cut both ways, because with women, if they're not skeptical or questioning and they tend to nod along in meetings and just kind of accept the advice they're being given without, really questioning that isn't always doesn't always result in a good outcome.
What do you think is the call to action here? I mean, certainly we know that not only are there gaps in terms of knowledge, there are certainly gaps in terms of pay equity. We know like all these other things. What should we be doing about this?
Well, I think some of the interventions don't necessarily have to be targeted to gender. So maybe more to personality. So if you know you're not a very conscientious person, you tend to be a bit lazy and undisciplined, then things like automating your savings, setting up an automatic savings program where a portion of your pay gets deposited into a separate savings or investment account is something that's really going to help you, because you're mitigating a weakness that you know you have. You know, to tell women to be, better with budgeting or better with making ends meet isn't really helpful, because they're already good at those things. But there are certain, women do also suffer from certain advantages, like the gender pay gap, like the fact that women tend to take more career breaks and our salaries peak earlier and we live longer. So we definitely have to do certain things to make up for some of those deficits. But it's not necessarily just a gender thing. And you really want to make sure these interventions that you're using are playing to the individual and, what they're good at and what they're not good at.
What does the data say about investing style? So there's a lot out there on the success of women as investors, how they approach it, how they think through these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, there's data that shows they're actually better investors once they get started. They start later, but once they get started, because they exhibit a lot of the qualities that make Warren Buffett a good investor. They're patient. They don't take they take well thought out risks, calculated risks, but they don't trade a lot. They're not overconfident. So a lot of those things that women make personality wise have in them, or more female type of characteristics, really serve them well as investors.
I spoke at an event on the weekend that had literally four men in the room. Of the 150, 200 people in the room, there were four men in the room, and I was one of them. It was a great event. It was the Ontario Home Economists Association, and it just skews female, right?
Just skews female.
One of the points that I made in that environment, because it is so female-dominated, is how important it is for women to engage, given the likelihood that they will be single at some point in their life. If we simply look at the mortality tables,
correct.
How do we have that sort of vested interest be ubiquitous instead of what it is today, which is really spotty? And people, if they are in a heterosexual marriage, they don't necessarily make sure that they're following along, and then their husband drops dead and they've got statistically another 4 years to go at minimum.
You're right. A lot of women aren't engaged and they kind of let their husbands take care of that stuff. And, understandably, you have a young child, you're busy at certain stages of your life. And if someone has more time and more of an affinity, it's easy to delegate that. But I think what women need to, and again, being agreeable is good in some ways because it means you ask for help. So I think for women, maybe working with a trusted advisor, someone that they really feel understands them, understands their personality, understands some of the challenges that they've had, you know, financially, and that can help them, you know, create a plan and then stay on track and deal with some of these things that do come up, like death and divorce.
In preparation for our conversation, you immersed yourself in lots of different studies and lots of different data points. We've talked about some of it, but is there another data point that you would want to bring to life in our conversation here to make sure that we included that in this conversation?
Well, I think the CPA Canada study was unique. I had never come across anything that really looked at the personality traits.
Yeah, it almost felt contrarian.
Yeah.
It almost felt, did you feel that way to you?
It did. And it was two researchers. I think they're from the University of Ottawa or Carleton University.
Yeah.
So it was rigorously done. And I mean, I think if you're interested, you can, you know, look that one up. So it's CPA Canada's website has it. But to me, because it's fairly new, and CPA Canada is doing a lot of stuff on financial literacy, a lot of research and a lot of community workshops and stuff. And I think they wanted to look at this issue because I think there is this perception that there is a gender gap in financial literacy. But when they really looked deeper down, there was a lot more at play. As you said, it's way more nuanced, and personality is a big part of that.
Robin, you have personality. I appreciate you bringing your personality to the show.
So do you. Thank
Robin, you. Robin Taube, CPA, author, financial expert. We're talking about the financial gender gap, what it is, what is real, and what's personality.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A lot of us are kind of curious about how people actually manage their money, not what, you know, the personal finance experts say and not what the blah, 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 what you should do, but what people actually do out there in their real lives. So this is why we came up with this segment called How I Do It, which is a series of basic questions that I'm going to ask of our guest. And they are questions that I would absolutely ask and answer myself. Our guest, Ivy Chu, RBC's senior director of their newcomer segment. Ivy, just the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
Sure.
You buy coffee at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit, and why?
Credit, because I use Starbucks card.
Okay. So what do you mean you use, like, a Starbucks credit card?
Well, it's the Starbucks app that is loaded onto your phone, and then you attach your credit card to it.
I see. Are you a big coffee drinker?
I am a big tea drinker.
A big tea drinker. What's your favorite? What's your go-to at Starbucks?
Their matcha latte.
Oh, that's pretty short. That's like four syllables. Matcha latte. That's three syllables. You should have a much longer order when you go to Starbucks, really, to get your mind.
Well, the longer
I'm ready.
Will be
give it to
the
me.
non-sugar version of matcha latte, extra hot.
Oh, extra hot. Okay. All right. What do you still use cash for, if anything?
Probably not a lot, because I think most places now take card, and a lot of places downtown especially are cashless now.
Yeah.
So there are not many places where we will still be using cash.
What about your financial life is automated? What's automated? And what do you still have to do, kick it old school and do? Like, do you actually have to pay a bill?
I think most of the bill payments are automated, especially those that are regular payments. I just automate it.
What about retirement savings?
That I do not automate, but I do it annually.
What about vacation savings?
I also do it automatically.
You do it automatically or annually?
A bit of both, depending on where I'm going.
Yeah, okay. How do you navigate your bills? Do they come to you in paper form or in email form? How do you pay them as soon as they arrive? Do you batch process them? How do you do it?
I do them as soon as they arrive, and they tend to be in electronic form.
Do you have a budget?
Yes and no. Generally, I do, but I don't count every dollar.
Do you have overdraft protection on your bank account?
I don't, only because I don't usually overdraft.
You would never overdraft. Are you kidding me? I work at RBC. My goodness. How many credit cards are in your wallet?
Let me think. You know what? I actually just came back from traveling, so I probably have more than usual. I think I have three, only because I used to work in the U.S. and I just came back from the U.S.
Right. What are you nuts about when it comes to your money, and what are you casual about? So, you know, I find that regardless of how people behave in finance overall. There are certain things that they really care about, they spend a lot of time on, and certain things are like, whatever, I don't even know. So in your those two categories, what would you say you're nuts about and what are you casual about?
I am probably more cautious and spend more time on investments.
Yes.
And looking at asset allocation. And I'm more casual about daily spending, that is just typical things that we spend on.
Right.
So not necessarily looking at the small things, but looking at the bigger picture and the larger items.
How many days a week would you say you buy food in the area of work, and how many days would you bring something from home?
I probably bring something from home once a week, and then most of the other days of the week I would buy near the office, but that's only because I live and work downtown.
Right. How much do you think you spend on lunch? Like when you go to a food court, what's like a, oh my gosh, I can't believe I bought that burrito, it's $12. And how much was like, wow, that was a good bargain. 6-inch Subway cold cut combo, bargoon.
On average, probably around $10.
Right. Okay. Who manages your investments? Are you a DIYer or do you work with a robo? Do you have a full service financial advisor?
All of the above, actually.
All of the above. And can you pass that off as research given your job? It's like, I got to try everything.
Exactly.
Really? You do? You use all three?
Yeah, I do. So I wanted to try all the services just to see which one would work for me in the long run. And I see pros and cons with all the things that you listed.
Yeah. What has been your best financial move ever in your life?
Probably getting my graduate degree, like investing in yourself.
Yeah. What did you study?
I study business at Stanford.
Okay. Yeah, that's worth something. I think it wasn't like a master's in paleontology or something. That's somewhat less marketable.
That's worthwhile, too.
Yeah. A master's degree from Stanford. Is it a two-year program?
Yes.
I'm ready to be shocked. What is the total bill on a two-year program at Stanford? I'm ready to be shocked.
It's around, tuition-wise, it's around above $100,000.
Per year or total?
Total
$100,000, and well, you know, California's cheap to live in. I mean, please, you can get a place for like $500 a month, right?
No, but then there's student housing, so it's a little bit more affordable.
Oh, okay, all right. Who files your taxes? You or an accountant or a bookkeeper or
accountant?
Accountant. Was it? Have you ever filed your own taxes?
Yes.
Why did you switch?
Probably just time. So I think when I was younger, I just like doing things myself and learn it myself and see how it works. And then now I know how it works. And I find that time is more valuable than trying to learn every single tax rule out there. So I find that having someone who specializes in these services would be worthwhile.
And that is how you do it. Ivy Chu, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ivy Chu is RBC Senior Director of their newcomer segment. She joined us for our How I Do It segment. That is our show for today. If you want some more moolala, you can download the podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast. You can post a review. And there's all sorts of places you can get it. If you're listening to this on SiriusXM, you can also go to Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, Spotify, all that stuff. Send us any thoughts, questions, feedback to ask@moolala.ca, moolala.ca. Thank you for joining us. Have a great day.